We check in now with Louis Bien, NFL writer for SBNation.com. Louis, I really appreciate you joining us tonight. And your piece that you released earlier this week, Comfortably Numb, the NFL Fell in Love with a Painkiller It Barely Knew, is up right now. And I found the premise of it to be pretty interesting. Like, I've known as an NFL fan for the past couple of years that Toradol was a thing, that it was a substance that guys use before games to get ready. But that's kind of the end of my knowledge. So assume that the rest of our listeners out there are sort of share my level of ignorance and explain to them what this is and how it's used.
Well, it's actually kind of funny you say that, because that's kind of how I started looking into it. It was just a painkiller that whose name I'd seen before, and I felt like nobody had really tried to explain what it was.
Yeah, I saw it. Like, sorry to cut you off. I saw it for the first time in Levitard's column about Jason Taylor a couple of years ago,
right,
with the Miami Herald, and just the crazy lengths that he went through to play. And then it's kind of like that's where the name recognition comes from. I'm aware that guys use it, but that's kind of the end of my awareness.
Right, exactly. And so what it is that it's a very, very effective painkiller, and the NFL likes it in particular because it's non-opiate. So if you ever see it written about, and it can get lumped in sometimes with like Vicodin or Oxycontin, but it's really not that. What it is that it's like a very powerful form of what they call a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which is a class of drugs that includes Aleve or ibuprofen, those kinds of things. But it's a much, much, much more powerful version of that, essentially.
Right, and everybody listening has taken an NSAID at some point, whether it's Advil, ibuprofen, whatever. I mean, we probably all share that in common. But Toradol, if it were as sort of benign as an ibuprofen or a naproxen or something like that, I'm guessing you wouldn't have wrote a long-form piece on it. Where does Toradol become dangerous?
So it becomes dangerous in the sense that because it is so powerful, it was indicated only to be used for severe post-operative pain, meaning that right after you have surgery, you're in a ton of pain, you take this because it's a very concentrated, powerful thing, and it works really, really well. Where it becomes dangerous in an NFL setting is that it gets used every single week by a lot of NFL players, and they'll take it even when they're not in pain. They'll take it when they're anticipating the pain that they're about to experience on the football field. So whereas the normal population would take it maybe once in their lives, right after they've, you know, get their gallbladder removed or whatever it is, you have NFL players who will take it 16 times a year with no real indication to take it, and how they use it is something that has never been studied before. It's only been studied for the way it's supposed to be used, which is maybe once, right? They say you're supposed to take it no more than 2 days in a row, and only when you need it, only when you're in severe pain, not as a treatment as it is used in the NFL. And it also has been studied, too, in athletic populations, which adds like a whole other layer of potential risk to the person, because you lose sweat, you lose sodium, you lose water, and that multiplies the effect it can have on the system.
Now, you mentioned that there hasn't been like a peer-reviewed long-term study about the conditions in which football players use it and whether or not it's safe, but it's been used at some level in the NFL since the early 90s, and your long-form piece features the story of Chris Kimoto, a guy, a former Pittsburgh Steeler, who almost, you know, died due to kidney issues. And it's unclear to me whether that's because of long-term Toradol usage or if it's something that if you have kidney problems, you can't take it. But in general, like, I guess if you could shine some light on that and then describe, like, are there other such cases that lead us to believe that long-term Toradol usage is really bad?
It's not that we know that it's really bad. The thing is that we just don't know, period. So there's been a lot of people that have alleged that they believe that their long-term use of Toradol has contributed to kidney problems. Like, there was a class action lawsuit a couple of years ago that had a ton of stories about Toradol use potentially causing long-term problems. Like, Marcellus Wiley was named in that, and so was the offensive guard for the 49ers. The name is just escaping right now. And there were a host of other people. And now there's another class action lawsuit that's essentially a sequel to that former one that got dismissed, where people are saying the same thing. So right now, it's really just anecdotal, but there isn't enough to really say right now that this causes long-term problems. But there's not enough to say that it doesn't either. I know that sounds a little wishy-washy, but what we do know is that it does affect the kidneys, and that the long-term use of it hasn't been proven. Right. I don't know if I made that clear, but it's just it's something that the NFL hasn't studied and no one has really studied before, and so there's a lot of players saying that it may contribute to their long-term problems.
Right. Right now we're checking in with Louis Bien, NFL writer for SBNation.com. His piece up right now, Comfortably Numb, The NFL Fell in Love with a Painkiller It Barely Knew, about the widespread Toradol usage in the NFL. And Louis, I completely hear what you're saying, that there just simply isn't enough information to discover the scale of the issues that long-term Toradol usage can create. But, you know, I am with you in that I wouldn't want to take something long-term that literally hasn't been studied in the way it's been using. Like, imagine going to the doctor's office and saying, okay, well, you have this issue, and here's this solution, but by the way, we haven't studied how it affects you for long-term usage or under the conditions that you're using it. You probably would say, you know, hey, how about we commission our study, you know, has been used on animals before? Like, I mean, you might have some follow-up questions, right? And it seems like these NFL players haven't been asking the follow-up questions. Rather, they've just said, you know, I want to suit up. And while that's a natural reaction, it you know, they could be facing a crisis down the road. I mean, is that sort of representing what you're saying?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just, I guess the point that I kind of really want to get across in peace is that there is kind of a power dynamic at play here, right? So the NFL sort of has leverage in the situation in that, you know, they pay the money and, you know, contracts aren't guaranteed, and they sort of have the leverage to say, well, if you want to play, you need to be on the field. If you want to, if you want your next contract, can you be on the field? And if not, here's your backup that's going to take your place. So players feel cornered in a situation where they're like, well, you know, I don't know exactly what this is, but I know it makes me feel really, really good. I know it takes the pain away. It's really effective. I've had, you know, veterans tell me to take it, so I'm going to take it. It's my only way to get my next contract.
Yeah, I just hope, and that's a great point with the non-guaranteed money on a lot of these contracts. Like, you know, Von Miller just signed for 114, but what's the guarantee? 70, right? I mean, that sounds good to the average person out there, but there are a whole host of players in the NFL that are, you know, signing one-year contracts, and they're not fully guaranteed, and they're for a lot less money. So I can see where that sort of insane pressure would come in to not only keep your playing time and your bragging rights and your competitive pride within your locker room, but, you know, keep those checks rolling in. And it is interesting to think about within the context of, you know, what someone will do to make sure that non-guaranteed money does end up coming in. And it is a unique amount of leverage. And Louis, we don't really have time to get into this right now, but I do wonder, with the 2020 collective bargaining agreement, in terms of the players' priorities, what number or how hard they'll fight to get more of that money fully guaranteed.
Obviously, it's something that Calvin Johnson cited when he retired. It's something that Eugene Monroe cited when he was a free agent, now retired. Obviously, Chris Borland left for health reasons. DeAndre Levy, who's a linebacker in the Lions now, mentioned Toradol. Like, it seems like something that players are becoming increasingly aware of. And you're right, it's interesting to bring up the 2020 negotiations, because there's starting to be a groundswell against the NFL about painkillers, and we're still 4 years out through the negotiations, but it's going to be interesting to see how much bigger that groundswell is going to get in the next 4 years.
All right, guys, SBNation.com is how you read his work. You can follow him on Twitter, at Louis Bien. Louis, really appreciate you giving us some time tonight on, you know, what is kind of an emerging topic in the NFL right now, the overusage of Toradol. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thank you.